All right, good morning, everybody. I better turn that mic down just a little bit. I'm glad it didn't get really bad. Okay, so this is Bio 231, and it's February 27th. I got the schedule on the projector, so you can check and see where we are. We're going to do a lecture on appendicular skeleton today. That's chapter 8. All right, and then on Wednesday, joints. That's chapter 9, and then that's the last chapter before the next test. All right, that's all the material that will be on the next test, but we're not going to take the next test until a week from, actually 2 weeks from today. And that's because next week we have lab practicums. I just don't want to have a lab practicum and a lecture test on the same day, so it's a little bit delayed, but hopefully that will help you. All right, so our next lecture exam is going to be on March 12th on chapters 6, 7, 8, and 9. All right, so we just got to cover two more chapters, appendicular, skeleton, and joints. Anybody have a question on the schedule? Everybody's pretty good with the schedule? Okay. Then... let's start talking about some bones that make the appendicular skeleton. And as a matter of fact, remember, we can take all the bones in the body and group them into two main groups. What are the two main groups? Axial and appendicular. What are some bones that make up the axial skeleton? Cranial bones? Yeah, like frontal bone, parietal bone, facial bones, mandible, zygomatic bone, and the bones of the vertebral column, right? C, T, L, sacral, coccygeal vertebrae, all part of the axial skeleton, as well as the sternum and all your ribs. How many thoracic vertebrae do you have? If you're absolutely normal, and probably everybody in here is absolutely normal, but we might find one person who isn't. But normally, yeah, you have lunch at noon, right? So you got 12 thoracic vertebrae. All right, and so today we're going to move on to appendicular skeleton, or bones that make up the upper appendage and the lower appendage. And why don't I want to just say arm for upper appendage? Because where is your arm? It's only from your shoulder to your elbow, and then you'd be missing out on your forearm and then bones of the wrist, hand, and fingers as well. Right, so we want to say upper appendage and lower appendage. For instance, I could point to this part of my anatomy right here. What would you call that? Is this my leg? Indeed, that's not my leg, it's my thigh, it's my what part of my lower appendage. Okay, so we're going to look at the bones of upper and lower appendage today, and the first thing that we're going to run into is that there are special bones that attach your appendages to your axial skeleton, and they're called girdles, right? And they're called girdles because they completely surround your upper thorax and your lower pelvic cavity. So the girdle for that attaches your upper appendage to your axial skeleton is called the pectoral girdle. And there are two bones that make up the pectoral girdle. They're the clavicle and scapula. And if you look on both sides, you can see that the both clavicles and scapulas completely surround your superior thoracic cavity. The girdle that attaches your lower appendage to your axial skeleton is called the pelvic girdle. And we're going to talk about those really shortly. All right, so the two bones of the pectoral girdle are the clavicle. It kind of looks like a rib. It's S-shaped, and it's got two ends. There's one end that articulates with the manubrium of the sternum, and then the other end articulates with a big, massive bony prominence on the scapula that's called the acromion process. And so this is what we call the acromial end of the clavicle. Here's the sternal end of the clavicle. And the clavicle is S-shaped. So here it is in one view, and both ends kind of look similar, but you're going to notice in lab that these two ends look a lot different because the acromial end, or the end that is lateral, is going to be very flat, kind of like a knife blade, but the sternal end, the end that articulates with the sternum right here, looks like the opening of a clarinet or a trumpet or something. It's much more massive. So when you look at a picture, you really are missing all of that information, which kind of underscores how important it is to go to lab and actually look at the bones because you can see it in three dimensions. So if you just try to learn bones by these two-dimensional pictures, that really doesn't help you very much in terms of the lab practicum. They'll look totally different. But once you learn the bones in lab, then you can use these pictures as a nice review. It will make sense. But you can't really learn the three-dimensional structure of a bone just by looking at these pictures. And even using all those really nifty drag and drop exercises in Blackboard probably don't help you either. You actually have to pick up a bone, turn it around, maybe model it on your body, see how it fits, and then you'll have a really nice idea. All right, so here is the clavicle. That's all you have to know about it, the sternal end and the acromial end. Acromial end is the lateral end. All right, and you don't even have to know superior and inferior view. That's part of the pectoral girdle. Here's the other bone that helps make up the pectoral girdle, and it's the, I tell you what, I got a question for you. Let's go back. What's the common name for this bone, for the clavicle? Collarbone. That's right, that's the collarbone. Here's another bone that has a common name to it as well, and this is called the shoulder blade. All right, this is posterior, makes up the posterior part of the pectoral girdle. And even though it's a posterior bone, here is the anterior portion of it. This is a portion that you don't see, right? Because it's a bone in your back. Unless you can look through somebody's body, right through their thoracic cavity, then you would look at this surface right here. This is the anterior surface of it. And there's a big depression in this part of the shoulder blade or scapula, and it's called the subscapular fossa. And it's subscapular because it's what? It's the deep part. So starting at your back and moving anteriorly, you have to go all the way through the scapula before you get to this deep part of it, so it's called the subscapular fossa. And remember I said it's really important to know and learn the bones really well because it helps you with all other parts of anatomy. For instance, since now you know this is the subscapular fossa, this part of the bone, remember a fossa is a depression for holding something, and what it's holding is a muscle, and now you know the name of the muscle that's in this location of your body because it's named after the part of the bone. And it's going to be called the subscapularis. So when we get to muscle, it's going to kind of ring a bell and you're going to say, I've kind of heard of that already. That's because you know your bones, right? So try to become really familiar with your bones. That will make learning other things really nice and easy. Right, so subscapular fossa. Here is another depression. This is a fossa. Sometimes we call it the glenoid fossa or glenoid cavity. Goes by a couple different names. And that's the spot where the first bone in your upper appendage attaches to the pectoral girdle. So the head of the humerus attaches right here. It's a ball and socket joint. So the head of the humerus fits right into this shallow depression in the scapula. Okay, and this is a really nice landmark because it's going to help you how to position this bone. And where does your arm attach to your axial skeleton? Is it right on midline or is it more laterally? Where is your arm located? Laterally, right? So this glenoid cavity, right, is going to be the lateral part of the scapula because that's where your arm attaches right there. All right, so therefore, then we know this is the lateral border, and then on the opposite side of the scapula is the medial border. This is the border that runs right up and down your vertebral column. If you were to run your finger down this area, you could probably feel the spinous processes of the vertebrae poking out right here as well. So you got medial border, lateral border. And then the inferior border of the scapula just forms a point. So we don't call it a border, we call it an angle. Here's the inferior angle. And then here's the superior angle that just is coming right off the medial border of the scapula. And sometimes there's a little notch right here. We call that the suprascapular notch. What does supra mean? Like we're going to say supraorbital foramen. That means above the orbit, right? So here's a notch that's above the major body of the scapula. And then here is the superior border. We have a couple very prominent processes on the scapula. The one that is posterior and it makes up the tip of your shoulder right here, it's called the acromion process. And then there's one a little bit anterior, we call that the coracoid process because it reminded somebody of a beak on a bird, okay? And that's what coracoid means. It means a little raven's beak right here. All right, so this is a really nice anterior view of the scapula, but let's look from a posterior view because that's really the view that you're most familiar with. This is a posterior view. All right, again, here's that long medial border. The glenoid cavity is going to be pointing laterally, so this would be a pretty nice example of a right scapula. It would fit on my right shoulder over here. So here's a posterior view, and you can palpate your scapula pretty easily, and you feel this big bony prominence right here. That's the spine of the scapula. Okay, I don't see anybody feeling the spine of their scapula, but you can, oh, I see a few people, all right? That's the spine of your scapula, and you can follow it out laterally. It goes all the way to the tip of your shoulder right here. So here's the spine, which leads you right to the acromion process, right? That's posterior, and then anterior, again, is that coracoid process. Above and below the spine of the scapula, there are some fossae, and these are depressions for holding muscles. The one above the spine is the supraspinous fossa. You probably don't have to memorize that. That's pretty easy, right? Just by nomenclature. Supra means above. All you have to do is remember here's the spine, and then here's the infraspinous fossa. These are fossa for holding pretty strong muscles that stabilize your shoulder joint. So this would be the supraspinatus and the supraspinous fossa, and this would be the infraspinatus down over here. So hopefully you're beginning to see how important it is to know your bones and pieces of bones. All right, so how many fossa are there on a scapula? How many did we look at so far? Okay, here are two, supraspinatus, infraspinatus. And then let's go back to the previous slide. Here's one right here, subscapular fossa. And then here's the fourth one, the glenoid fossa. Some people call it glenoid cavity, but there are four fossa. Okay, three hold muscles. But this fourth one, the glenoid cavity, actually holds part of the humerus, which makes the shoulder joint. So I can see all four fossa on the scapula from this lateral view because the glenoid cavity is lateral. Right, we started with the subscapular fossa, which is anterior, and then the infraspinous fossa, which is the posterior part of the scapula, and then here's the supraspinous fossa right here. Again, that's on the posterior part. Here's that big spine of the scapula that you can actually feel poking out on your shoulder blade. All right, so what two bones make the pectoral girdle? And what's the job of the pectoral girdle? What are the two bones first? Scapula is one, and clavicle is the other. Yeah, shoulder blade and collarbone. And what do they make up? Pectoral girdle. What's the job of the pectoral girdle? A girdle surrounds something. They're surrounding the thoracic cavity. But I'm thinking of a little bit more functional. Besides surrounding the thoracic cavity, what's their big job? It's kind of like the interface between two major parts of your body, of your skeleton. The pectoral girdle helps attach your upper appendage to your axial skeleton. Okay, that's probably good for you to know that. All right, so let's look in your arm that's between your shoulder and your elbow, and you have one bone in that region. It's called the humerus. And in lab, you're going to palpate this proximal epiphysis right here. You're going to feel it's nice and smooth, right? And it's a condyle. What's the function of a condyle? Function of a condyle is for articulation. It forms a joint, and it's been nice and smooth. So when the head of the humerus rubs up against the glenoid cavity, it doesn't grind those bones down, right? And it's going to be covered with articular cartilage, which is nice and smooth. So here is the head. There's a little depression that just distal to the head of the humerus. And what would you call that? So if you just think of your whole body, not just this particular arm, here's your head, and then there's a little narrowing that's distal, I mean, that is inferior to your head. What do you call that? Your neck. Yeah, so here is the anatomic neck right here on the humerus. It's just a little bit of a narrowing. A lot of bones have necks that are just distal to the head on the bone, right? We call that the anatomic neck because it's still a very massive part of the bone. It doesn't have a tendency to fracture very easily, but notice down over here, the bone gets a little bit narrow, actually a lot narrower right here. This is typically where the humerus likes to fracture when it's presented with too much trauma, and so this is what we call the surgical neck, this region right here. So here's anatomic neck, here's surgical neck. You're going to find some rough parts, rough raised areas on a bone. What's the general name for a rough raised area on a bone? It starts with a P. A process. What's the function of a process? More than likely it's for muscle attachment. These processes right here are so special that they're giving special names. They're called tubercles. But they're still a process, and you can actually see in this picture how rough they are. Here is the larger one. Here is the not-so-prominent one. So here's the greater tubercle. Here's the lesser tubercle. These are for muscle attachment. So we're going to want to remember those when we start talking about muscles. And then here's a long depression between the tubercles, and a long depression in some surface of your body, whether it's the surface of a bone or surface of your brain, we call it a sulcus. Right? So sulcus is just a big long fossa. Sometimes we could actually call it a groove as well. And this one right here, since it's between the tubercles, we call that the intertubercular groove. There's an important ligament from the biceps brachii that goes right between this and goes into the scapulae. Oh, I forgot to mention something about the scapula, but I'm going to go back to it. All right, then we have, what part of a long bone is between the epiphyses, like in this region right here? That's a diaphysis. Right at mid-diaphysis, there's another rough raised area on a bone, and that's usually what we call a process, but this one is pretty special. Right, we call it the deltoid tuberosity, so tuberosity is a process. And guess what the name of the muscle that inserts right here? Deltoid muscle, which covers your shoulder, and it helps elevate your humerus. It's got a special name. We're going to talk about what that motion is called in a couple of days. All right, so deltoid tuberosity. Then we get down to the distal epiphysis, and this is probably the hardest part of the lecture, talking about this distal epiphysis of the humerus, because let's go to anatomic position, right? So my hands are down by my sides, and which way are my thumbs pointing in anatomic position? Laterally, yeah? You could say out, but I might say what? Okay, laterally. All right, but what can you do with your hands? In anatomic position, your palms are facing anteriorly, but you can actually rotate your forearm so that the palms face posteriorly, and notice that my humerus doesn't change position. It's just the bones of my forearms that are changing. So the elbow joint is pretty special because it acts like a hinge. We call that flexion and extension. But you can also rotate the palms of your hands. We call that supination and pronation. We'll define those terms in a couple chapters coming up. All right, and that happens at the elbow joint. So it's kind of a complicated joint. It has special surfaces for articulating. But in general, what do we call an articulating surface on a bone? It's going to be smooth. Just a general name for an articulating smooth surface on a bone. It starts with a C. It's called a condyle. So here are some condyles on the distal epiphysis. I see one right here that looks like a sphere. That's called the capitulum. And then here's another smooth articulating surface. Kind of looks like a spool or a bobbin you'd wind some fishing line on, for instance, or maybe you have some other ideas what you could wind up on this thing right here. And that's called the trochlea. All right, now let's look at the head of the humerus. What edge of the humerus is this right here? Is this the medial or lateral edge right here? This is going to be pointing toward your scapula, which is medial. So here's the medial edge. Here's the lateral edge. So the capitulum is lateral, and the trochlea is medial, right? Here is some bony prominence that's above this condylar surface. So here's the medial epicondyle. That's for muscle attachment, right? And then sometimes we call this the lateral epicondyle right over here. And epi means what? On top of, like epidermis is that layers of skin above the dermis. All right, so let's go back to these condylar surfaces right here. Capitulum is the spherical one. The trochlea is kind of shaped like a bobbin. And you're just going to have to memorize the names of these two condylar surfaces and also memorize what bones articulate on these surfaces right here. All right, now in the arm, you have one bone, but in the forearm, where do you have your forearm before we talk about it? Here's your forearm between your elbow and your wrist. In your forearm, you don't have one bone, you actually have two, okay? And in anatomic position, the lateral bone is what we call the radius, and the medial bone is called the ulna. So let's relate that to the distal epiphysis on the humerus. So the lateral bone, and do you believe this is the lateral part of the humerus right here? Indeed, because look at the head. So the radius articulates with the capitulum, and the ulna articulates with the trochlea. So if you can't see that, then you have to memorize it, and then after you memorize it, then you'll probably see it, make it pretty easy. Okay, so trochlea. Let's look at a posterior part of the humerus. So here's a posterior view, and I can see the surgical neck outline here. Here's a greater tubercle, lesser tubercle we can't see because it's too anterior to see. Then here's the head, nice articulating surface. There's that deltoid tuberosity. I don't see the capitulum from this posterior view, but I do see a little bit of the trochlea, and I see a big depression in the posterior part of the humerus. We call that the olecranon fossa. That's for holding something. And what it holds is this big bony prominence that you see right here on the tip of your elbow. That's called the olecranon process of the ulna. When you straighten your arm out, that big process kind of disappears, and guess where it disappears into? Right into this olecranon fossa. So it fits right in that distal epiphysis of the humerus really nicely. Okay. And since the olecranon process is part of the ulna, you can see that right below it is the trochlea, which is that articulating surface for the ulna that's on the humerus. All right, so here's a zoomed-in view of the distal epiphysis of the humerus. This is a nice anterior view, so we can see the capitulum that's laterally located and the trochlea that's more medially located. And now we can see the two bones in the forearm. Laterally is the radius, and then medially is the ulna. And maybe some of you are kind of familiar with that because there are times when you want to check somebody's pulse, maybe count how fast their heart is beating, and we palpate an artery. And a lot of times people just call that the radial pulse, right? And it's called the radial pulse because what's the lateral bone in the forearm? It's the radius bone, and there's an artery that goes down the radius bone, and so we call it the radial artery, and when blood squirts through it, it produces the radial pulse, right? Because it all matches up with the radius, which is the lateral bone. What's the medial bone in your forearm? That's going to be the ulna. And you probably haven't memorized all that yet, but the more you hear me say it, probably the more familiar you get with it, right? All right, so the lateral bone is the radius, and the medial bone in the forearm is the ulna. Okay. On the anterior side of the ulna, here we have a coronoid process. So when you flex your forearm, right, this process has to fit into a depression in the humerus, and we call that the coronoid fossa. So the coronoid fossa accepts the coronoid process when you flex your elbow. Okay. Let's look at a posterior side of this joint. All right, so here is that big bony prominence that makes the tip of your elbow right here. That's the olecranon process. So when you straighten your elbow out, that process disappears. It disappears into what? The olecranon fossa in the humerus. All right, so this is the ulna. What bone is this, medial or lateral in your arm? Ulna is medial and radius is? Lateral, right? Because you've probably taken somebody's pulse or your own pulse. Okay. So let's look at some bones of the forearm. Here's a pretty good isolation. So we're looking in this region right here. All right, we've kind of looked at the elbow joint already. Here is the head of the radius. And this articulates with what condyle? What's the name of the condyle on the humerus? Let's go back. Okay. Here's the head of the radius. Let's go back one more slide. So we flipped it over. Here's the head of the radius. What does it articulate with? The capitulum. So you might have to write that out like 10 times. Head of the radius and capitulum match up. All right. The trochlea matches up with the ulna. And what's the part of the ulna that the trochlea matches up with? It's going to form a little hook like this. It's going to hook into the humerus. And it's called the trochlear notch. So that's not too hard to remember. The trochlear notch articulates with the trochlea, okay, on the humerus. So capitulum with the head of the radius, trochlear notch with the trochlea on the humerus. Here's that olecranon process. Here's that tip of the process, the hook that fits into the olecranon fossa when you straighten your arm out. All right, down at the distal end of the radius and ulna, there's a couple little pointy processes that we call a styloid process. What's the function of these processes right here? Muscle attachment, right? Just always kind of think muscle attachment. And along the diaphysis of both the radius and the ulna, there's a joint, because I see some connective tissue between them. We call that the interosseous membrane. It's a movable joint. It's kind of a semi-movable joint. It stabilizes the radius and ulna, okay, it allows for some motion, but not quite as much motion, for instance, as in your elbow. Okay, we do see that the radius and ulna also come together. What do we have between bones when they come together? A joint, right? So here is a joint on the proximal, and then here's the joint on the distal end. And these are freely movable joints because you can rotate your palms back and forth. So there's going to be a nice depression in the ulna right here that accepts the head of the radius. You can see that's nice and round. There's going to be a nice depression down here in the radius bone that accepts the head of the ulna. So check that out. The head of the radius is proximal. The head of the ulna is distal. But that's because these bones can rotate around each other. So let's take a look at these. Oh, it's going the wrong way? Why is it doing that? I wasn't watching the cursor. So if we look at, if we look at this joint right here, just kind of keep that in your mind, and I'm going to go ahead a couple slides. Here is a depression in the ulna that the head of the radius, so here is the head of the radius, it fits into this depression on the ulna, and we call that the radial notch because the head of the radius fits in here. So in lab, I actually want you to palpate that little depression. You're going to see that it's rough, or would you expect smooth? Smooth, because it's a condylar surface. It's going to be a nice smooth surface. All right, so here you see the tip of the elbow, the olecranon process. Here's the coronoid process, that's anterior. Olecranon process is posterior. And then here is that notch, right, that fits right into the trochlea. And so the name of this notch is the trochlear notch on the ulna. And then here's the radial notch in the ulna. Then what bone is this right here? Matches up with the thumb. That's the radius. The head of the ulna fits into a corresponding notch in the radius. What would you call this notch in the radius? If this is the radial notch in the ulna, this is going to be the ulnar notch in the radius. Right? So you don't name these notches by the bone that they're on, but by the name of the bone that is touching it. Right? Just like the sutures in the brain. All right, so let's see what the next picture looks like. Here's the radius coming down, and then here is the ulnar notch in the radius that accepts the head of the ulna, which is going to be right here. And then you got the styloid process on the radius and styloid process on the ulna right here. All right, so that's bone in the arm, two bones in the forearm. And then we got some bones that make up the wrist and the hand, and another section over here. Commonly, we call these things fingers. But in anatomy, what do we call a finger? A digit. That's right. Okay. And normally, you have five, unless you have polydactyly, which means you have more than five. You could have six. I've never seen anybody with seven. But every once in a while, somebody with six. Not very common at all. And so we have bones that make up the wrist, bones that make up the hand proper, and then bones that make up the digits. And don't forget, a digit is just really a finger. So let's take a look at some of these things right here. Some nice micrographs. So here we have a hand. And in lab, for sure, I want you to be able to tell the difference between a hand and a foot. And remember, bones support a lot of weight. So what do you think should have bigger bones, feet or hands? Feet should have a lot bigger bones. So that's the easiest way of telling. Right, and all of these bones that I see here on the hand are pretty small compared to the ones in the foot. Okay, so let's analyze this hand. The bones that make up the wrist, which I am outlining right here, these are wrist bones, and we call all wrist bones carpals. Every single one, all eight of them is a carpal. And as a matter of fact, we can also see some bones in the forearm. The lateral bone, the radius right here, is really big and massive. And then the ulna, here's the head of the ulna. That's pretty small. Right? So that's a nice way of recognizing the radius and the ulna as it articulates with the carpals. So all of these bones are going to be carpals. I do want you to know the name of one of these carpals. And it's this one right here. It's right underneath the radius. And notice how big and massive the radius is and how small this scaphoid is, right? And it's the lateral bone in the wrist, in this first proximal row right here, and it matches up with the thumb. So you can find it on your body because it's going to be like right in here, okay, or right in here. When people trip and fall, okay, so if you're conscious, right, as long as you don't pass out, you like to catch yourself before you hit the ground, right, whether you're falling backwards or forwards. And you land on the palm of your hand, which is right here, and your radius, which is this big strong bone here and here, goes crashing into your wrist bones, in particular, which one? The scaphoid, right? So when people fall, this is the bone that most frequently breaks as a result of that. It's called the scaphoid. That's why I want you to know something about it. And something else that's pretty interesting, when the radius pulverizes the scaphoid right here or fractures it, it also damages the blood vessel that goes into that bone that supplies oxygen and nutrients. And remember, bone is what? Living or dead tissue? Living tissue. How could you convince somebody that it's living tissue? Because it has what? It's got cells. Yeah, what's the name of those cells? Osteocytes in there. And when you damage that blood vessel supply to the scaphoid, it doesn't heal. As a matter of fact, it likes to dissolve away. Right? So when you break a wrist, the scaphoid has a tendency to disappear. And when you change the structure of the wrist, guess what happens? You change the function of the wrist. So people have motion deficits as a result of that, probably for the rest of their life, right? Unless the damage wasn't so bad. So that's another good reason to know something about the scaphoid, because you'll see it all the time if you end up in some kind of clinical setting. Okay? All right, then I can see the styloid processes here on the radius and the ulna as well. So all of these are carpals, and then here is the scaphoid, and you know because it matches up with the thumb and the radius. Right there. So that's the only one that I want you to memorize. All these other names you don't have to pay attention to, but you should at least know as a class of bones, what would you call all of these? They're all carpals, right? And then the bones of the hand right here are long bones, and these are what we call metacarpals. All five of these are metacarpals. They don't have specific names. They have numbers starting with which digit? Your thumb. Okay, so your thumb is number one, index finger is number two, little finger is number three. What about ring finger? Which number is that? Four, right. All right, so just start counting from your thumb like you're hitchhiking someplace, all right, starting with the thumb. So this would be the number one metacarpal, number two metacarpal, number three metacarpal, and this one here is? What's this one right here? Number five what? Metacarpal, which makes up what? Palm of your hand. Those are the bones in the palm of your hand, right? So go ahead and feel your hand. Maybe you can even feel some of those bones in there. All right. Then we have digits, right? Starting at the distal end of these metacarpals, we have digits, and of course we have five digits on this particular person. Let's look at number five. Which digit is that? That's your little finger, okay? Let's count the bones. I see one here, I see another one in the middle, and then I see one on the tip. All right, so there are three bones. Each one of these bones is called a phalanx. And then they're given a designation by number, like in the little finger. All three are going to be number five, but sometimes you might break one or the other, but not all of them. So we want to be able to talk about each one of these bones individually. So this would be number five proximal phalanx. And then here is number five, middle phalanx. And then here is number five. If this is proximal, what would you call this one? Distal. Yeah, number five, distal phalanx. All right? So phalanx is singular. Phalanges is what? The plural form of that word. So in the little finger, how many phalanges do you have? You've got three, right? You got proximal, middle, and distal. You don't want to call this medial because it's not middle. It's sandwiched between the distal and proximal, right? So it's in between the two. All right, what about number two digit? How many phalanges do you have? Three, proximal, middle, and distal. These are all number two, right? And then all of these, two through five, have three phalanges. But let's look at number one. How many phalanges does number one have? I see here is number one, metacarpal, and then here is number one, proximal phalanx, and then I only see one bone left right here. I don't see a middle one. So this is the distal number one phalanx. So the thumb, when you look at your hand, for sure is a lot shorter because it only has two phalanges. There's no middle phalanx in the thumb. All right, so that's all you got to know about the hand. It's pretty easy as long as you don't start counting with your little finger. You always want to start counting with what? Your thumb, right? And then the other thing that you have to memorize, the bones that make up the wrist are carpals. Bones that make up the hand are metacarpals, right? And then bones that make up the digits are phalanges, right? Phalanges. All right, so that's the hand right there. All right, so I've been yakking for a little bit. What about questions? Anybody have any questions so far? The brute memorization that you have to do pertains to the elbow. What do you have to just start memorizing like today? The articulating surfaces, the condyles, okay? What are the special names of the condyles on the humerus? There are two. There's the capitulum and the trochlea. Which one is lateral on the humerus, the capitulum or trochlea? Okay, the capitulum matches up with the radius, so it's lateral, and the trochlea is medial because it matches up with the ulna, in particular, what, the trochlear notch. All right, so that's really the hardest thing with the upper appendage is that elbow. And that's because it's a pretty cool joint. You can flex and extend at the elbow, but what else can you do? You can actually rotate the ulna and radius with respect to each other so you can pronate and supinate. For the bone test, you don't have to know the names of motions unless we talk about that in the next chapter. I forget where I talk about it. The other thing that I see right here are a couple sesamoid bones. And a sesamoid bone, I think we talked about, is a bone that's completely embedded within a tendon. So there are some tendons, right, that go from number one metacarpal up to the digit up over here, and those tendons have embedded in them these sesamoid bones that just help with the articulation, help stabilize this joint right here. So they're kind of funny. You might have sesamoid bones in other parts of your hand, okay, and those usually are due to some kind of inflammatory process. Maybe if you're working a typewriter all day long, or maybe if you're in dental hygiene and you're using your hands a lot, you might get sesamoid bones and other digits, and that's going to be due to an inflammatory process, which then inflammation causes pain in that particular region, but not down over here. All right, so that's the upper appendage. How does your upper appendage attach to your axial skeleton? What's necessary? You got a special structure. You've got the pectoral girdle. You got the pectoral girdle for your upper appendage, okay? What are the bones of the pectoral girdle? Clavicle and scapula. Which one is the posterior one? The scapula. And anterior is the clavicle. Okay. Well, just like you have a pectoral girdle that attaches your upper appendage to your axial skeleton, you have a girdle that attaches your lower appendage to your axial skeleton. And what the heck is that called? That's called the pelvic girdle. Okay, so here's the pelvic girdle, and you can see it's completely surrounding your pelvic cavity with a little bit of help of the axial skeleton right here. Here's the sacrum. All right, so here's the sacroiliac joint right here. All right, so there are two major bones that form the pectoral girdle instead of four that makes the, two major bones that make the pelvic girdle compared to the four bones that make the pectoral girdle. And these are called os-coxae. Os-coxae actually are the fusion of three different bones, and we can see them labeled right here, the ilium, the pubis, and ischium. Right, the superior bone is the ilium, the most inferior is the ischium, and the one in front is the pubic bone. These all fuse together during development to make an os-coxae, or sometimes we call it a coxal bone, or hip bone, but os-coxae is a very common term for this. This is what makes up the pelvic girdle. All right, so let's look at one of these bones right here, the os-coxae, and take a look and see what we have. All right, this is probably the most challenging bone for you to know. Here is a large depression in a pelvic bone, kind of similar to the glenoid cavity or glenoid fossa in the scapula. Right, and remember, the head of the humerus articulates with the glenoid fossa. The acetabulum is a fossa. What articulates within the acetabulum right here? it's going to be the head of the femur articulates. And in lab, you're going to see that the acetabulum is a really deep depression, so that the femur inserts very deeply into the hip, so the hip is a much stronger joint compared to the shoulder as a result. There are some trade-offs with that, okay, because the glenoid cavity is shallow, it means it's a relatively weak joint, but guess what you can do with your shoulder? All kinds of fancy things, right? You can move your humerus in front of you, behind you, above your head. You have an extreme range of motion, right, because the glenoid cavity is shallow. So you have good range of motion with the shoulder, but it's relatively weak. With the hip, right, because of the depth of the acetabulum, it's strong. The hip is a lot stronger. But what about range of motion? It's way reduced as a result. So that's typically what we consider a trade-off. All right, so this bone that's in the superior part, that's what we call the ilium, and it forms like a fan. And the name for fan is ala, so this fan-shaped bone right here is just part of the ilium. That's called the ala. And this ascoxae is big and massive because it's holding up a lot of body weight, but you also have very powerful muscles that attach to the ascoxae. And, of course, whenever you pull and push on a bone, it gets bigger and stronger as well. So the ascoxae is a big, strong bone in most people, unless you are suffering from osteoporosis. Then it gets weaker and weaker and weaker, and it can fracture pretty easily when we get up into our 80s and 90s and things like that. All right, so here is the iliac crest, which is a process for muscle attachment. All right, we see some other processes that are called spines on the ilium. And remember the pubis bone, the pubic bone right here is anterior. So if we go right up the anterior side of the ascoxae, I see a spine here and a spine here on the ilium. This is the anterior superior iliac spine, and then right below it is the anterior inferior iliac spine. These are for, what would you use these for? Or what do you use these for in your own body? A spine is a process. And what's the function of a process? Muscle attachment. Yeah, so there's going to be big, powerful muscles that attach right here. All right, and since the pubic bone is anterior, then I know these are the anterior parts, the anterior spines. But if we go back over here, when we move back, what part of the ascoxae are we looking at over here? Right, if these are anterior, what's back over here? The posterior. And I see two spines again. So here's the posterior superior iliac spine and then posterior inferior iliac spine. Again, these are going to be for muscle attachments as well. Okay. Now, one easy way to tell anterior from posterior on an ascoxae, right, is not just to look for the pubic bone right here, but to look for this nice big notch. Here's the greater sciatic notch, and that's mostly on the ilium, partly on the ischium, and you can see that the three bones have different colors on this diagram, so you can tell the three different bones. And then here is the lesser sciatic notch, and there's something separating the greater from the lesser sciatic notch, and we call that the ischial spine. So here are the iliac spines here and here, and here is the ischial spine. Why do we call this the ischial spine? What bone is it on? It's on the ischium. Yeah, it's on the ischium. It's not on the ilium. So that's a point of confusion, right? So I don't want you to go down that road. Between the sciatic notches is the ischial spine right here. And what is the function of this ischial spine? Muscle attachment, or ligaments that attach right here. Okay. All right, now we got the ischium. So here's the ischial tuberosity. And look, it looks really, really rough. So there are going to be big, powerful muscles that attach right here as well. Okay, it also is the part of your pelvis that you're sitting on right here. And that's why we call this name, the name of this bone is the ischium, because we compress tissue when we sit down. Like muscles and other kinds of soft tissue, when we compress that tissue, blood can't get into it, and it becomes, what we say, ischemic, right? When a tissue is lacking blood supply, we call it ischemic. Like ischemic heart disease means that your heart is not receiving the proper amount of blood flow, and then it can't function properly. And if you cut off the blood flow to a heart, what happens to it? Not only does it become ischemic, it actually dies as a result of that, right? That's really a bad thing. All right, so here is the ischium, and then anteriorly is the pubic bone right here, and then acetabulum. All right, so what view is this, medial or lateral? Where does your, how does your humerus attach to the scapula? Is the humerus lateral or medial to the scapula? The glenoid cavity is facing laterally, right? Because your upper appendage is attaching. And the same thing for the zascaxae. Here is a lateral view because the head of the femur is going to attach to the lateral edge of the zascaxae. All right, so that means we want to look at the medial side. Here's the medial side, and the medial side helps form that bowl. So here is part of the ala of the ilium, but on the medial side it forms a fossa. We call that the iliac fossa for holding something. I bet you could take a guess. What's it holding right in here? It would be pelvic organs, like urinary bladder, uterus, maybe some digestive organs, right, that are being held in this region right here. Here again is that iliac crest for muscle attachment. Remember, the pubic bone is anterior. And what about the ischial spine? Ischial spine is going to be posterior between the greater sciatic notch and lesser sciatic notch. All right, so here's the posterior view of an zascaxae. Here is an anterior view. All right, so here on the ilium, you get the anterior superior iliac spine, anterior inferior iliac spine, and then if we flip to the other side of the bone, this is going to be what? Posterior. So here's the posterior superior, posterior inferior iliac spine. And do you want to call this the an iliac spine, where I have the cursor? You do not, because it's actually on which bone of the zascaxae? It's on the ischium, right? All right, so this is the ischial spine between the greater and lesser sciatic notch. Here's an obturator foramen. That's a nice, easy landmark to see. And then here's that pubic bone. Right, here's the superior ramus of the pubic bone. Here's the inferior ramus. And remember, a ramus is just part of a bone that juts off at a 90-degree angle from the body of the pubic bone. So here's the ischial ramus. Here's the body of the ischium here. All right, so the Wednesday lab, right, will have a picture as a extra quiz to take labeling both the sacrum and also the zascaxae right here, and it could be a medial view like we see right here, or a lateral view. All right, that's your extra quiz, and I've also invited the Monday lab people. If you want practice labeling this bone right here, because this is an exam figure. But this bone could also be on the practicum. If you want to stop by my office hours, I'll let you practice taking that quiz, just a labeling quiz. But it won't, for the Monday crew, it won't be for any course points. But for the Wednesday, it's possible that it could be for course points, right? But just for practice before the practicum. Because when do practicums start for these bones? Yeah, next week. So Monday for the Monday labs, and then Wednesday of next week for the Wednesday group. So you want to really practice getting to know some of these bones. So don't forget those really cool exercises in Blackboard. But in particular in lab, you got to pick these bones up, turn them around so you can see what the superior margin looks like, what the inferior margin, and then put them on your body. Right? If you can turn them around so they fit on your body, then you have a pretty good picture in your mind what they really look like. All right, so that's an zascaxae, coxal bone. Oh, here's a nice, relatively smooth surface. This is going to articulate with what bone? Right here. The auricular surface is going to articulate with the sacrum right here. Okay, and the sacrum has an auricular process as well. All right, so in the arm, how many bones are in the arm? I think of one. Okay, which is the humerus, right? Between the shoulder and your elbow, that's your arm. And all these other bones are where? Forearm, wrist, right hand, digit, so forget about all those. All right, so how many bones in the arm? Just one. How many bones are in your thigh? It's going to be an analogy compared to your upper appendage, so you have one bone in your thigh as well, right? And that is, as we see on this diagram right here, it's not highlighted in color, but you should be familiar with the name of that bone, and that's going to be, sorry about my cursor jumping around, that's going to be the femur. Okay, so here's the femur, and I don't want to go back to this bone, so I'll talk about it right now. Down in your knee, you have another sesamoid bone. What's a sesamoid bone? It's a bone that is inside a tendon. A sesamoid bone is inside a tendon. So there's a tendon that goes, that attaches muscles in your anterior thigh to some bones down here in your leg. Right? And that's called a patella. What's a common name for patella? Kneecap. All right? And it's sort of triangular shape. The point of the triangle is pointing inferiorly. We call that the apex. And then the base of the patella is superior. One side is really rough because that's where all the tendons attach. The other side is really smooth because that's the side that's going to articulate with the femur. Okay, so that's the patella right there. That can be fractured if you hit your knee really hard, if you fall and you hit your patella first. All right, but let's talk about the femur. This is analogous to the humerus that's in your arm. So here is a nice head of the femur. It's an articulating surface. So is that going to be rough or smooth? That's going to be really smooth, and it's going to be covered with articular cartilage. Then this little narrowing right here. Actually, it's a fairly significant narrowing. That's the neck of the femur, and the femur can fracture fairly easily in the neck, so there is no surgical neck in the femur. Anatomic neck and surgical neck are really the same thing, so we just call it the neck. The femur does have tubercles like the humerus does, but since they're so big and massive, we call these trochanters. Here's the greater trochanter, here's the lesser trochanter, and then we've got the diaphysis. There is a long, narrow process for muscle attachment that we call the linea aspera, right, which is just a nice straight line on the posterior part of the femur. And then the distal epiphysis has condylar surfaces for articulating with bones in the leg. All right, so what about the head of the femur? Is it medial or lateral? So I say my thumbs are the head of the femur. In order to attach to my axial skeleton, which way does the head of the femur have to point in order to attach? Medially, like that, right? Okay, so the head is going to be pointing medially, so down over here, this epicondyle is the medial epicondyle. Here is the lateral epicondyle. And since these are condyles, this is the lateral condyle. Here's the medial condyle. And you can tell very easily just by looking at the head of the femur. Also in lab, you'll notice something. There's a pit or a depression in the head of the femur. And that's for a ligament that goes from the femur to the coxae. What's the part of the coxae that the head of the femur fits into? It's nice and deep. It's the acetabulum. So there's a ligament that helps stabilize that joint. So there's a little pit right here called the fovea capitis. But there's also a blood vessel that goes into the head of the femur right here from the acetabulum. Kind of follows that. It follows that ligament. And sometimes when you have trauma to the hip, it will damage that blood vessel. And remember, that blood vessel is bringing oxygen and nutrients to this part of the femur. So if that blood vessel gets destroyed or damaged, guess what happens to the head of the femur? It dies. Those cells in there die, and then the head of the femur starts to dissolve away. And you can imagine what that feels like. Instead of a nice, smooth, articulating surface, you have just a jagged point sticking up into the acetabulum. And guess what somebody needs then? A hip replacement, which is fairly easy surgery these days. Okay, probably wouldn't feel that way if you were actually see it happening, because remember, bones are highly vascular. It's a fairly bloody procedure, but the outcome is usually excellent. Okay, when you put a metal prosthesis in there. As a matter of fact, there was a professional athlete. He was tremendous. He played both professional football and professional baseball. Okay, same season. Anybody know who this was that played in the outfield? And he's a running back in football. And it was Bo Jackson. And unfortunately, somebody tackled him really hard in the hip region, and it damaged that blood vessel right there. And he needed a hip replacement. Okay, and then so he got his hip back. He couldn't play football anymore, but he was such an excellent athlete and the surgeon did such a good job, he went back and played professional baseball, even with a prosthetic joint, which is amazing. So you could look up Bo Jackson, right? Just phenomenal athlete. So we could all, right, do really well with a prosthetic hip. Okay, down over here on the distal epiphysis, you see the condylar surfaces. Make sure you know which one is medial and lateral. Again, easy to tell by the head of the femur right there. And in between the medial and lateral condyles, we have the intercondylar notch or intercondylar fossa. And there's some important ligaments that go across the knee joint that attach in this region right here that we're going to look at probably in lab after the practicum or even at the beginning of lecture next time when we look at the knee joint. And then here is the articulating surface for the bone that is just anterior to the knee. What's that little bone that's just anterior to the knee? It's a sesamoid bone. Yeah, it's the patella, right? And here's where the patella articulates. So we call this the patellar surface on the femur. All right, and just like in the forearm, you have two bones. How many bones do you have in your leg? Yeah, where is your leg? It's between your knee and your... and your ankle, yeah, knee and your ankle, that's how I would think about it. And here they are. A little bit tricky here too, because you got to memorize which one is medial and which one is lateral. It's easy for me to remember the bones of the forearm, which one is medial and lateral. Lateral is the radius, because I'm used to taking like a radial pulse, right? And the ulna is medial. But in the leg, it's a little bit different, because we usually don't mess around too much with the leg. All right, we do bang our leg sometimes. This area here we might commonly call the shin. And there's a nice prominent ridge, really narrow, called the anterior border or anterior crest. So if you hit your shin on something, that hurts really bad because there's not a lot of muscle in front of it or anything. You just kind of crash the bone. The medial bone is this huge bone, and it is that tibia. And during a test, if either the practicum or the lecture test, if you forget which one is which, you can always just palpate your leg and you can feel a big, strong bone right there, and it's the medial bone. And if you go lateral, there's just so much muscle you can't even feel the fibula, which is the lateral bone right here. All right, so when we look at the head of the tibia, right, it's got two condyles as well. One is the medial condyle, right, and one is the lateral condyle right here. But you just got to somehow remember that the tibia is medial and the fibula is lateral. We got a couple ridges between the condyles on the tibia. We call these the intercondylar eminences or the intercondylar eminence that has, it's a process, right? But in this particular case, it's not for muscles, but it's for ligaments that stabilize the knee, ligaments that go from the tibia up to the femur, the superior. But now here is a true process right here. Tibial tuberosity. You're going to really like this one because there's big important muscles in your anterior thigh that insert right here for like a kicking motion. All right, so tibial tuberosity. All right, and then your ankle, your bones that kind of stick out right at your ankle, they're called the malleolus. All right, here's the medial malleolus. And you can palpate your malleoli pretty easily. Right here, the medial malleolus on the tibia and the lateral malleolus on the fibula. And unfortunately, it's really easy to confuse these malleoli unless you memorize the tibia's medial and the fibula's lateral. Unfortunately, I'll see that a bunch of times. So write that down in your notes. Make sure you know where the lateral malleolus is. What bone has the lateral malleolus? It is the fibula. And which bone has the medial malleolus? It's the tibia, right? And that will actually help you with understanding something about the knee joint as well. All right, so that's pretty much all about the tibia and fibula. All right, it has an interosseous membrane, just like between the radius and the ulna, but it's not too complicated because your knee is a pure hinge joint. Okay, so you can flex and you can extend. But unlike your elbow, which you can rotate, can you rotate your knee? No, you don't ever want to rotate your knee. If it does rotate, then some bones are going to break or some ligaments are going to break or a meniscus might break. We'll talk about meniscus a little bit later. All right, so that's not a good motion to perform. All right, so what other bones do we have in the appendicular skeleton? Oh, here are the bones in your leg. You can see the intercondylar eminence right here. And the smooth condylar surfaces for articulating with the condyles on the femur. All right, that takes us to the foot right here. I want to come back to that picture in just a little bit. All right, so you could think of a foot as the same way as your hand. You have wrist bones in the hand, and in the foot you have ankle bones. What did we call all those bones that make up your wrist as a group? They were called carpals, okay? But in your ankle, we don't call them carpals, we call them tarsals. So all eight bones are tarsals. And of the carpals, I wanted you to know one. Of the tarsals, I want you to know two that are really important. The bone that makes your heel, that strikes the ground when you walk, is called the calcaneus. So that's a big, massive bone. And it has important muscles that attach to it, so it's big for that reason as well. So it supports your whole body weight. It's really big, but there's big, important, strong muscles that attach to it. All right, but that's not the bone that articulates with your tibia and fibula. Right, the bone that articulates with your leg bones is the talus, which is right here. So the talus that's superior to the calcaneus, those are the only two tarsals that I want you to know the names of. So I see calcaneus and talus. I see calcaneus and talus. And then from a superior view, the most superior bone is the talus, and then down below it is the calcaneus. These are tarsals. All right, and then you have bones that make up the foot proper right here. These are, instead of metacarpals like you'd have in your hand, these are metatarsals, and they're just given numbers 1 through 5, starting with your great toe, just like your great finger. Okay, so that's number 1, and then your little toe matches up with number 5. So this would be the number 3 metatarsal, number 1 metatarsal. And the phalanges are named exactly the same way as in your hand, right? Most have 3. Digits 2 through 5 have 3 phalanges. Digit number 1 only has 2. So here is number 1. How would you call this one? Number 1 what? Number 1 proximal phalanx. Here's number 1 distal phalanx. And then let's go to number 2 digit. So here is number 2 proximal phalanx. Number 2 middle phalanx. And then number 2 distal. All right, so there's 3. All right, so the same thing for 3 and 4. So let's look at number 4 phalanges. Here's the number 4. Which one is this? Proximal. Here's number 4. Middle. Okay, and then here is number 4 distal. All right, but there's a difference. Remember, there's a difference between middle and medial. All right, so a lot of people are going to say medial phalanx for this one right here. But it's not medial to any of these right here. It's what? In between the proximal and distal. And so what do we call between something? It's in the middle, right? It's not medial. It's just in the middle of the proximal and distal phalanx. All right, so that's the bones that you have to be aware of. All right, there are some curvatures in the foot. Okay, so you have different arches in the normal foot. You have this medial longitudinal arch and a lateral longitudinal arch, and then you have a transverse arch that goes from right to left in the foot. And this just helps distribute weight as you're walking. Right, so these arches absorb a lot of shock so that these bones and so that your ankle works properly as a result. So that's why these arches, so you should probably know something about these 3 different arches that are in your foot. One thing I wanted to go back and show you is this x-ray. Okay, so I see it's a fractured one, unfortunately, but let's not pay attention to the fractures necessarily. Here is the fibula, which is what, medial or lateral? It's going to be lateral. Here is the tibia, which is medial. Right, and I can see a little fracture here and a fracture right up over here. But let's put these bones back. All right, so do you see, so here's the medial malleolus, here's the lateral malleolus forming a nice notch. If you put the tibia and fibula together, forms a nice notch that accepts the dome of, what bone is this right here? I'll give you a hint. It's a tarsal of some kind, but what's the most superior tarsal? That is the talus, right? So the talus fits right between the lateral and medial malleolus of the fibula and tibia. Right? So that's a really nice ankle joint, which is pretty much just a hinge joint. And then here you can see the tarsal that strikes the ground when you walk, and that's called the calcaneus. So calcaneus and then the talus. Those are the only two I want you to know. Okay. So the sign-in sheet is going around someplace. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. And that's all I have to say today. But next time, we're going to start to talk about joints. And joints have a lot of nomenclature with them. So please make sure you do the pre-lecture reading assignment and look over that chapter with joints a little bit so it's not so mysterious when I come into class. Okay, because we're going to classify joints as to whether they're slightly movable or immovable or freely movable, and then what kind of material makes up the joints, like fibers. What's your favorite fiber? Probably elastic because it goes back the way it was, but the strongest is collagen. If collagen is your favorite fiber, that's okay with me. The answer key?
Yeah.
Answer key probably should have popped up right at
10:30. Oh, at
10:30? Today. Okay. So it should be open right now for, which one is this?
Oh, that's for...
appendicular skeleton? That should be available now.
Okay.
So right after class or right during class, the answer keys open up.
The other one, is that how you want it to be?
Let me turn off my microphone.
Okay.
Okay, so for the lab quiz for today, ooh, look, that almost fell off, but it was still recording. Okay.